This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, here's Johnny Gould. This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
You've got the watch, we've got the tone.
I've known Tim Marshall across 30 years. Our paths have crossed radio and television newsrooms at Independent Radio News, LBC and Sky News in London. And we've stayed in touch as he became a best-selling author on geopolitics. He's one of the media's good guys. He stays clear of political commentary. Instead, he sees the world from the viewpoint of the people and places that he observes. And that makes for the integrity of his commentaries and analysis.
Basically, we just really need to try as hard as we can to understand the other side and seek to make compromises. I'll leave you with that. I actually think compromise is a beautiful word.
Understanding people from their perspectives in such a short supply in today's social media rage.
For those who listen, for those who are willing to listen, this is Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
His latest, Power of Geography, 10 maps that reveal the future of our world. Click on the link in the episode description to buy now. And stay tuned for an adult conversation on a snapshot of the world today.
I do believe we are hardwired to be suspicious of the other. What we can do is overcome that hardwiring, but it takes a lot of work. But I start from the basis of geography, then you layer on history and politics.
We can learn a lot from Tim and his generosity of spirit.
Tim, you talk in the language of peace. You're a kind guy and a good mate in the business. And I thank you very, very much for your time today.
That's really very nice of you to say. I am. I think most of us are.
This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State. North America, Europe, the Commonwealth, the whole of the Middle East.
The world is listening.
Tim Marshall, a warm welcome to Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you very much, Johnny.
Now, we've known each other for 30 years in both radio and TV newsrooms. I was on your LBC radio show a few years back, and I remember when your fledgling writing career began with a chat about football chants, and you've come a long way since then.
Well, yes, it's been downhill all the way, because that's possibly my favourite book, Dirty Northern Bar Stewards, shall we say. I thought it was a terrific book, explaining the UK through the unpleasantness we hurl at each other on the terraces.
Indeed, indeed. The power of free speech will always transcend political correctness on the football terraces.
Now, very much so. Not always positively, but I'm interested to see some of the chants from a sociological viewpoint. So that's one thing. But the other one is about VAR, which I am personally wholly against. I think it's ruining the game.
Tim, the power of geography is a firm rebuttal to those who say geopolitics is over. That technology had rendered borders obsolete. Now, your title is the starting point in kind of ridiculing the end of history as a concept.
It's a nonsense. A, history never ends, and B, geography is always important. What is important about it can change with technology, but it doesn't make the geography itself not important. And people who argue that, you know, all the distances have been collapsed and that geography is irrelevant, well, go to a small farmer in the Nile Delta whose government is now trying to persuade him to either change what crops he grows due to water and how much use there is for certain types of crops, or even telling him to move far away from his current farm because there may be a water shortage, because Ethiopia, X hundreds of miles away, is building a dam on the Blue Nile. I mean, it's as important now as it ever was. As for borders, this is just wishful thinking. I've always argued that the worst song John Lennon ever did was Imagine.
Right.
I mean, you can imagine no borders, but not seriously. And my example is, we've done away with the borders. There's a fishing area, let's call it Grimsby, and they've only got so much fish, and one year there's not that many. And then some people from somewhere else come along, let's call it Norway, and start fishing there, at which point they go and have a chat with them about it. Well, that's a border. You're never, ever going to get away from them.
Now, the multipolar world is in a state of flux, considerable uncertainty. New competing powers must come to terms with their own geographies as they engage in their sudden new statuses. Once upon a time, America was the top of the hegemony. They had a bit of Soviet Union action. They were on their own for about 20 years. But now we're looking at India, we're looking at China, we're looking at a new Russia, and maybe even a conglomeration of the countries who've signed the Abraham Accords just to the south of the European Union might become, in their soft power ways, or indeed in technological ways, world powers.
All players, serious players, I would still argue that the Americans are at the top of the pile, primarily because of military, but perhaps also economically. But yes, we're clearly in well advanced into the multipolar world. And the difference between that and a bipolar world is that when you've got lots of actors using the space that a non-bipolar world gives them, by which I mean there isn't a world policeman or two world policemen anymore, then they seek, quite understandably, to advance their interests. Turkey is the best example. Turkey would no way have behaved in the way it's behaving at the moment during the Cold War, wouldn't have bought a missile defense, its main missile defense system, from the Russians. But there are many other examples. So that's one of the reasons for the uncertainties of this age, which are greater than they were in the Cold War. But there are many, many other reasons behind them. But I'm also arguing in the book that we are rapidly approaching a new form of bipolar world. I only use that phrase as shorthand because I don't know what exactly it will look like, and a new Cold War ditto. But you can already see countries making their choices. You can already see, for example, Myanmar has given up on détente with the Americans and has pretty much thrown its lot in with the Chinese for the long term. Conversely, Australia and the UK have clearly no longer hedging their bets about America and China. UK, for example, two examples, kicking Huawei out of the 5G system is one, and another one is sending the aircraft carrier, the new aircraft carrier, to the South China Sea. They both tell you that as far as the current government is concerned, the choice is made, the die is cast.
That is an extraordinary thin slicing of how a multipolar world really, really makes decisions right across, which have consequences for absolutely everyone. Let's start with the biggest country in the world, that's Russia. It's enormous, which rather than being a total advantage, must wrestle with defending that. For example, Russia can't have a functioning navy all year round because it freezes in the winter. And I've seen you speak on other podcasts about the idea that they're so big, they neither call themselves or think of themselves as either Asian or European, a sort of continent on their own.
That's a reference to a time when I was up in the Urals Mountains, which is the traditional dividing point between Europe and Asia. And I was with a Russian cameraman, and there's a monument up there. And we were up in the snow looking down into Siberia, the West Siberian Plain. And I said, "So come on then, what are you, European or Asian?" And he said, "I and we are neither. We are Russian." And, you know, it really struck home, made me think a lot about it. As for the size, yeah, I mean, some of their ports freeze for part of the time, and they have to go up through the ice pack of the Arctic to get into the sea lanes, or they have to come out of the Black Sea into the Aegean and then into the Med, and then only then can they try and get into the Atlantic, ditto out of the Baltic. It's not easy. So, you know, geographically, as a naval power, they're in a poor position, despite being so large. Also, with a population of 30 million now, I think, for the biggest country in the world, it's a big space to defend. Flat land in front of its main population centres is a poor defensive area. And all these things have helped shape what has happened and how they think. And the greatest example is actually from the one of my earlier books, Prisoners of Geography, which is that armies keep charging through Poland, Poland is flat land. It's the narrow gap between the Baltic and the Carpathian Mountains. It's flat from France right through to the Urals. And if you're Russian and if you've been invaded from that direction so many times, inevitably, I think, your political class will seek to either plug the gap, Poland, or at least dominate the land in front of it, which is Belarus and Ukraine.
Are you playing catch-up with Johnny Gould's Jewish State? I've had the pleasure of some really great guests. How about Douglas Murray?
Israel is a rare country in the West in that it does buck many of the trends. I mean, there isn't a fertility rate problem in Israel, for instance, as there is in most European countries. There is a strong feeling of nationhood and of the debts that the country needs to call upon in order to unite its people.
And Hillel Noyer, whose UN Watch keeps check on the excesses and mission creep of the UN human rights in Geneva.
The challenges are great. They're not going away. I am concerned by the cultural revolution that we've experienced in America in the past 5 years, known to some as the woke revolution, where there's a kind of a McCarthyism. If you say something, it could be canceled and fired from your university, from your corporation, from a journalist. And often it's an anti-liberalism. So that, to be honest, really scares me, because we need our democracies to be healthy, to be honest, to be truth tellers. So I am deeply concerned.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee. ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.
Let's talk about America still being out in front militarily, but they've gone through periods of isolationism and then sudden re-engagement with a president who wasn't always easy to predict. And now we've had a volte face with Joe Biden and his administration looking very much like the Barack Obama administration of 4 years before. So with that in mind, are Russia in Syria because America is letting them? And why do they obsess with the Ukraine as they did with Crimea and South Ossetia?
Russia's in Syria because of a number of reasons. One is that Obama simply didn't care about Syria, and in fact, most American presidencies haven't. But I think the current one does particularly, because it's not really that strategically important to them, and they're pivoting to Indo-Pacific. So with that, it was easier for Russia to insert itself into the Syrian conflict. It wanted to safeguard its warm water port. It's only a small port, but it's the only one they've got on the Mediterranean. And they needed to keep Assad in power to do that. But they've also made themselves a player in the conflict. If you want to solve that conflict, you need to talk to Moscow. And when you do, Moscow says, yep, love to help. Now then, about the sanctions you've got against us on other issues. So it was a very useful ploy. It was a limited expedition. I called it the IKEA flat pack expedition. People were talking about it being, you know, a new Stalingrad or their version of Afghanistan, which was always utter nonsense. And they've pulled it off, I think. Now, Russia has been on the front foot since about 1999, since Kosovo, and they've inserted themselves in various places. And they've done it extremely successfully. I don't think Mr. Trump pushed back against them very much. I think Biden will a bit more. I think there'll be a tougher line on Russia and an equally tough line as Trump took on China.
Now, that Syrian war is a total tragedy. It ramps up, it continues, and the world, like you say, like so many presidents, don't seem to care about it. Russia are in there, as we've discussed. Iran are in there, trying to build a land bridge to Israel, as Colonel Richard Kemp told me. And we'll come on to Israel in a moment. But the Shia-dominated nations around Iran, like Lebanon, Iraq, and the Alawite Shia cousins of Syria, are making Iran's pan-Arab, they're not Arab, but sort of pan-Arab, pan-Muslim nationalism a real threat to not just the region, but also to the world?
Yeah, the Iranian foreign policy has also been partially successful, and the Americans partially delivered it to them by getting rid of Saddam Hussein. I'm not making a case for or against it, simply saying that's what happened. And when the Sunni Saddam was overthrown, and with him the Sunni-dominated regime, a Shia-dominated regime came to pass. So now you have, for the first time in history, an Iraqi or a Mesopotamian, if you prefer, entity that is cordial towards the Persian Shia. And then, yes, as you mentioned, the Alawites are an offshoot of Shia Islam, which is why Iran stepped in also to save Assad. And then the last bit of that land bridge you mentioned is Beirut, which links to the Mediterranean. And Beirut is dominated by Hezbollah, the most powerful military entity in Lebanon, much more powerful than the actual Lebanese army. And Iran has very successfully kept that corridor open. And the Sunni-dominated nations around it have been trying to cut it, and they failed.
And indeed, as we are seeing in the constant wars in Israel and Gaza, a battle between a terrorist rocket attack and an Iron Dome defensive radar, and windows of opportunity in the four Gazan wars so far fought between now and back to 2008, opportunities for Israel, small windows of opportunity for Israel to blow out the metro tunnels, to get rid of some of the embedded terrorism inside, you know, urban areas. Which brings us on to radar and satellite technology and its deployment from space. I mean, Tim, this is the next stage of this world pressure of warfare. Will it create, will space create more competition between world powers and create new opportunities amongst the biggest ones?
Probably. It also creates the potential for cooperation, which we have seen in space. Wars will be increasingly technological. Well, I suppose they always have done. You know, I mean, once you find out that if you make your bow out of a certain kind of wood, the arrow will fly further. You know, it's always relied on technological advances. But people often mistake that for being all powerful. The Americans in Iraq, for example, and for all Israel's military technology, in the event of several Israeli soldiers being kidnapped by Hamas via one of the tunnels and dragged back into Gaza, just those three or four people could change the entire dynamics of a conflict, even when you've got Iron Dome and the rest of it. So going back to, and on technology also, I think not many people really noticed the awful war in Nagorno-Karabakh last year, when basically the Armenian army, its armor was just wiped out from the air by drones by the Azerbaijanis, mostly supplied by the Turks. And the Armenians had not invested in drone warfare, and the Azerbaijanis had. Right, onto space. It doesn't have to be this way, but there is obviously competition between a lot of countries, but primarily Russia, the USA, and China, with China and the USA at the head. And a lot of it is commercial, and this is the difference between the Cold War and now in the space race. Then it was very much about proving that your system was superior. And so the Russians were the first into space with the Sputnik, and then the first to put a dog into space and a man into space, and then the Russians caught up and overtook them. But that was about proving your system. This is somewhat different. This is actually about ensuring you have the military advantage by positioning your satellites. And I'm pretty confident all nations will develop killer satellites for defensive purposes. And a war in space would be catastrophic because it could kill our economies because it'll knock out the satellite systems. And moving on from that, though, is the commercial advantages. And although a lot of it is by commercial companies, such as Elon Musk's, I've never seen anything where commerce and government was not interconnected. The East India Company is a very good example.
Right.
You know, the British Army often did things to the advantage of the British East India Company, for example. And so if it comes to pass, as I believe it will, that country X has the ability to get to a massive asteroid and mine it for rare earth materials, a misnomer there, but you know what I mean. I mean, there's one, for example, which is supposed to have as much worth of rare earth materials on it as the entire US economy over 1 year, trillions of dollars. Then there's probably going to be competition for that. Let's hope it's peaceful. Ditto the moon. The Artemis Accord signed last year split the moon up into spheres of influence, but Russia and China were frozen out of the Artemis Accords, and they are not bound by them or anything else that those other countries have signed. So if anybody wants to enforce their zone of influence, I'd like to see by what legal justification they would so do.
That is a phenomenal future-orientated prediction there. Back down to Earth and a conflict which is creating huge world headlines and creating social problems across the whole of the Western world. How would you judge Israel's political geography, Tim? A lovely long coastline, but smaller than Wales.
What is it? 12 miles wide as well.
Indeed. And IDF soldiers defending their borders, they don't even need binoculars to see the families that they come from and that they're defending, as you say, 12 miles wide at its narrowest, and rockets flying in. I spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus about the latest Gazan war, and he tells me that of the 4,000 rockets fired into Israel, there are still 8,000 to be spent by Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Israel is fighting the ultimate defensive battle.
The geography is difficult from the Israeli perspective. The coastline is beautiful and brings in a lot of tourist dollars. But you've got two problems. One is the Golan, the high ground. Well, it's not a problem anymore because it was taken militarily. And so Israel will never, I don't believe, and well, until in decades to come, the Middle East turns into a version of the EU. At that point, perhaps the Golan would be returned. Because the Golan, as the high ground, protects Israel from two potentially hostile countries. The West Bank is an issue because it's also high ground. And from the West Bank, you look down into the plain in front of Tel Aviv. And when you look each side of that, that sort of very roughly 80-mile corridor is where the vast majority of the Israeli population and industry is located. And not being in control of the high ground, if the high ground is controlled by a potentially hostile entity, gives Israel a headache. So although, because of this geography, there may one day, God willing, be a two-state solution, I don't believe that two-state solution would include the border with Jordan being part of the second state. I think the Israelis would always insist on having that 1 or 2 mile buffer zone, possibly with a land swap to compensate, because they have to hedge against the deal that they do with the now state that accepts them, the Palestinian state, does not in the future turn hostile and then begin to get the sort of heavy weaponry via that border up into the high ground. And so these geographical issues play into all the negotiations that are ever had. On the current situation, Iron Dome is miraculous. I think that photograph, I think it was an AP photograph, is destined to go down as one of the defining photographs of modern warfare. You know, you've probably seen it, Johnny, on the
indeed, it's
right.
Incredible.
Yeah, the barrage of rockets lighting up the night sky coming out of Gaza. And then this swirl of Iron Dome missiles, which are sort of moving in all different directions as they triangulate where they're going to go to hit those missiles. I think that's one of the defining images, both of this conflict and the modern warfare. 10% still get through. Israel will not stop until it... Well, I think Israel has probably already achieved its one of its major objectives, which is to deal Hamas such a blow that it will buy a period of relative calm. I don't know if it's a year or 8 years. Hamas has already achieved its objectives in that it has successfully positioned itself as the defender of the Palestinian people and probably won itself some friends. And if and when it ever does come to elections in the West Bank, people are so sick and tired of the PA, Hamas may have succeeded in doing what they've tried to do, which is to persuade enough people to switch to them.
Mahmoud Abbas is rumoured to have called off an election because he feared that Hamas would indeed win.
I believe that's why. I mean, he said in the current situation with the tensions, etc., you know, this is, he's delayed for 15 years. I think he knows that Hamas is growing in strength in the West Bank and he didn't want to risk it.
I'm intrigued about something you said a couple of minutes ago about if the Middle East became a version of the European Union, which with its multiple religions and ideologies and statehoods and the basis of those statehoods sounds quite incredible. And yet, Tim, we might have the kernel of a sort of European Union, perhaps even a model for the European Union to adopt, which is the Abraham Accords. I mean, on one level, the UAE and Morocco and Sudan will never join Israel in a Middle Eastern North African union as such, because they're all so radically different. And yet, that nation-state model might be something which might have persuaded some Brexiteers to vote to remain.
I'm not getting into Brexit.
I'm just trying to see the point you make
about the Abraham Accords. And it does give a lie to all those people, John Kerry included, who said, let me tell you this for a fact, there will never be peace agreements between the Arab countries and Israel until Palestine is sorted. I mean, that was always not true because
you did good impressions.
People never understood that the governments, and I think we do need to make the distinction, Johnny, the governments of many Arab countries are sick and tired of the Palestinian issue and quite happy to make peace with Israel and try to forge a new era. But huge numbers of the populations are not. And that's another reason why Iran has been sending the missiles to Hamas, because if they can break the Abraham Accords, they would be very, very happy. And there has been fairly large demonstrations. There was a very big one in Algeria against Israel. I haven't really detected anything bigger than any time before of the outrage at human loss of life. And the governments have been, I suggest, muted in their criticism, including the Saudis. And there was a very interesting article written in by a Saudi, who is a regime guy, he's not a dissident, in one of the major Arab newspapers, which it does condemn Israel, and it does call it indiscriminate firing and all the other things that you'll be used to hearing. But it also reserves absolutely equal criticism to Hamas and explains why Hamas needs as many Palestinian fatalities as it can get in order to advance its aims. I mean, they would call them shaheed, martyrs, that it's worth people sacrificing themselves for what they regard as the greater good. So it's not like it was before. It is a new time, possibly a new era. The Iranians are trying to break it. At the moment, it doesn't look like breaking. And if you can build on that through years of calm and sort out the problem, which I'm not convinced will happen in the near future, then the Middle East and EU, including Israel, they're in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Well, that is true. And the last time Israel won it was not that long ago. In fact, they frequently win it in a people's riposte to Gary Lineker and John Oliver. The migration crisis in Europe, which is obviously connected to the wider area around Israel, to the Middle East and North Africa, is the biggest destabilization to the EU. And I think we're seeing in election after election the centre shrinking and extremes growing on both sides, even in this country on the hard left and in France on the right.
I agree. And actually, it's something very interesting I noticed in Spain. You know, you've seen the recent 8,000 desperate people trying to get to the Spanish exclave on the Moroccan coast.
Ceuta and Melilla.
Hoping to get to Spain. Well, the hard left party in Spain, their leader came out and accused Morocco of using people. He clearly took the "we need to protect our borders" stance, which for the hard left is difficult for them to do. I think you're right. I think the bigger effect has been on the hard right. And I think this week's events on the Moroccan coast will strengthen the resurgent right in Spain. Vox and a newly resurgent Republican Party together could potentially form a government. And I've been arguing for several years now that the figures we saw in 2015, 2016 of that crisis where Angela Merkel welcomed people and then told the EU countries how many they would take, and some of them said, no, we won't. I don't think that's a peak. I think what's happened subsequently has been a lull, and there will come a time and a catastrophe in the future where we'll see those numbers exceeded. And I think the European response will be to build higher walls and for their politics to shift further to become hard-hearted, which is why I further argue, because I don't want that to happen, that we don't reduce our foreign aid budget, as we're doing. We actually increase it. Now, you can argue it from bleeding heart terms, and I can, but you can also argue it from selfish terms. If you don't want these countries to empty out, leave behind the least well-off, can't make it, have a brain drain, and have people coming in numbers which are not managed, but in the sort of scenes we've seen, then let's do more, a lot more, to try to help alleviate the conflict, the climate change and the poverty, which is driving the movement of peoples.
That's a very, very substantial argument for someone's own benefit. Now, we are being bombarded in the media in the West about China. And indeed, if Frankie Goes to Hollywood was still recording, maybe Two Tribes would be about the US and China. But China has...
Showing your age there. For younger listeners, this was a popular beat combo of the 1980s.
Several decades ago. But China has a regional problem. And one of the things that you always state, and the book always talks about, is that you must look at each country's geopolitical actions from their perspective, not ours. And they are Billy No Mates in the Far East. You know, we've got Japan, we've got South Korea, Indonesia, Vietnam, Malaysia, who are all allied to the United States. There's a Chinese wall of American allies which have always stopped its engagement around the world. So perhaps reports of America's demise are somewhat overstated, and China's rise is also being quelled.
Yes, and why should it be? Why shouldn't they rise to be the dominant power? There's no sort of statute of limitations on these things. But I argue it's very important to look at things from both angles. But what we often don't do is look at it from the perspective of the other side, if you like. And there's a map I often use, which looks outwards from China into the Pacific, because we often look at it the other way around. And it shows this wall in front of them, consisting of some of the countries and others that you said. And again, in geography and geographical and military strategic terms, if you have Japan and its islands, well, it is a series of islands, and then South Korea, which also has some islands, and Taiwan, and then move down to the Philippines, the gaps in between, in naval terms, especially if you have 11 aircraft carrier groups, which the Americans do, is relatively narrow. And consequently, you can be blocked, theoretically, China, from getting out into the Pacific. Ditto, you can be blocked from moving through the Malacca Strait, and they depend on the Malacca Strait to survive, basically. It's one of the reasons why the whole Belt and Road Initiative is going ahead to try and have an alternative to that. So from that perspective, it makes sense that China builds its shorter ship missile system, which it is doing, to push the potential aggressors further out into the Pacific. It makes sense to cajole or dominate each of those countries in the wall to flip and join them, which they're not being successful at all. And it makes sense to build islands in disputed territory, such as the Spratly Islands, which I think it's the Philippines and Vietnam both claim as well, because you make yourself stronger. So when you look at things from Beijing's perspective outwards into the world, what they do and why they do and what they might do in the future becomes a lot easier to understand and potentially predict. And it's another reason why Australia is not hedging its bets anymore. It's read the future. It believes that the Chinese will probably get past the first island chain. Well, the second island chain is on their doorstep, and they would prefer to keep them as far away as possible.
So, of course, countries who have always regarded America as their undying friend, and we talk about the special relationship here, and Israel talks about it with the United States. Mike Pompeo, one of his last jobs in the Trump administration was to fly into Israel during the pandemic and tell Netanyahu, you know those ports that you're doing with Chinese money right up and down the country? Well, perhaps you'd better think twice about taking their money. Is it important for us to reach out to the rest of the world in that multipolar way and stop repeating this default idea of a special relationship, whether we think it exists or not?
Well, I think this concept of global Britain, which is very, very loosely defined by Boris Johnson, I think he came up with it when he was Foreign Secretary, is much more than the alliance with the United States of America. That said, I think that will remain the most important alliance, and I think that the Johnson administration has nailed its colours very firmly and clearly to the mast. But global Britain does mean moving out more into the world, and we are seeing that at the moment with efforts to get the trade deal with Australia. Rightly or wrongly, you know, I'm not making, in nearly all of these cases, Johnny, I'm not making an argument for or against anything. I'm just stating how I think it is.
Yes.
Ditto Japan, and also why the UK is trying to join the Trans-Pacific Economic Agreement. You know, I mean, we're not a Trans-Pacific country, but these things are very fluid and very flexible these days. And the UK is actually trying to get into that market as an equal partner. It may well do so. Japan is actually backing its admittance. But there's no getting away from the fact that we actually live opposite the biggest and richest market in the world, which is the EU. And, you know, we've got to get that economic policy and political policy right as well. So, but you see, a lot of this is actually underpinned by the Americans. This whole concept of the D10, the group of 10 democracies, or some people say D20, you can just pick a number between them and, you know, add some countries. That is all underpinned by the United States. You take the United States out of any of these equations, and nobody is strong enough on their own to make a firm stand on certain issues. And that includes Israel. You know, Israel, I don't think, would have survived without American help. It certainly would have been an awful lot more difficult. And you can say that about several Arab countries as well. So, you know, I think the current strategy is based on a solid foundation of the past, but also a bet on the future that this is not a declining power. Other powers are rising to meet it, possibly China, very possibly India, but less likely than China. But if you haven't got America, I think inevitably, as the years roll on, pressure from China, both its economic and its military power, would start to get countries to lean towards it. So make your choice. make your choice. Do you go with the incredibly flawed democracy that's powerful, or do you go with the incredibly flawed one-party police state?
Right. And of course, you talk about American power being syndicated around the world, and we think about the UN and NATO, although the UN is looking very much like a 20th century entity in this multipolar era of chaos. And is there an is there an existential threat? Are we looking at a League of Nations-style buckle before breakdown? NATO has suffered a huge crisis of confidence, partly because Trump tried to force a reset.
Yeah, very clumsily, and you know, he really, honestly, I don't think he knew what he was doing. I've never argued that he's stupid, but I just think he's incredibly ill-informed.
Yes.
On the UN, the Security Council is moribund. We've seen it again with the Americans blocking the statement on Israel. You know, whether you're for or against that blocking is not the point. The point is that it's yet another example of how it's a moribund Security Council. When you come to the UN as a whole, it's not an exact comparison with the League of Nations, because the League of Nations really was pretty much set up to do what the Security Council is supposed to do, and that is to get into various arenas of conflict and try and sort them out equitably between everybody, or to put pressure on one aggressor, etc. The UN's much bigger than that, and so it does do incredible work around the world in helping people in medicine, in development, in all sorts of things. But you're right to describe it as a 20th century body. Its hierarchy reflects the victors of World War II. That was, you know, getting on to 100 years ago now. And I think it has to be reformed root and branch. I don't think it will be, because I can't see any of the permanent five, the P5, like the UK. You know, Boris Johnson's not going to get up tomorrow morning and think, you know what, it's really silly. We're a country of 65 million. Let's give our place to India or Brazil.
No,
it's just not going to happen. So it will continue to be weaker and weaker as the years pass, I believe.
So we've decided that borders are important, and the best physical borders in the world are those that belongs perhaps to islands, after all is said and done. And Britain's relationship with the EU changes now. How are we set as an island? Ports, physical borders, and of course a timeline which lends itself to global powers. You know, it's 5 o'clock over there and it's midnight over there. We're right in the centre of it. And it lends itself to those global powers in different parts of the world. We're verdant as well, and we're also very windy. These have been great things in the 17th, 18th, 19th and 20th century for sure. What about the 21st century?
We had oak trees to build a navy. We had coal to fuel it 100 years ago. And now we are, because of our geography, very well positioned to make use of wind, especially in Scotland, and rain, especially in Lancashire. Manchester, you know, I'm sure they should have a wind farm. Actually, that's something of a myth, but I digress. No, we're geographically, the UK has long been in a very good position, especially once the world modernised, let's say, you know, from, well, picky date, 15th century, let's say. I mean, we were a windswept island at the very periphery of history for a very, very long time. Certainly were when the Romans rocked up. But as the world changed, and the sort of beginnings of globalization appeared on the horizon, as I said before, we were positioned, unlike Russia, with direct access to the sea lanes of the world, with no one to block us. Further, we had all this wood to build a navy, but we also had indented ports with indented coastline, which means a potential for deep water ports, which we have. And deep water ports mean big ships, and big ships mean ocean travel, and ocean travel means global trade. So countries that didn't have that advantage. Also, our rivers go quite a long way inland. I mean, the Thames, you know, you can get big ships 30 miles up in to the great city, and then distribute them. So all these things were to our advantage, and many of them still are. Certainly access to the sea lanes, difficulty in blockading us, deep water ports, big ships, now a very good pre-existing transport network, needs a bit of modernization, but there we are. And then the wind and the rain, as we try to wean ourselves off fossil fuels, also puts us in a good position. The heritage of the great successes of the previous century have now allow us to have a very educated population. Some of the British universities you'll find there in the list of the top 20 universities in the world. We still have a great amount of soft power to project out into the world, which we use very well. We still train many of the future titans and politicians of other countries. And so we're not in a bad position geographically, but that's the geography. You've got to get the politics and the economics right. And the example of how not to do that is Argentina. I mean, we are now, I think it's the fifth or sixth biggest economy in the world. In 1907, Argentina was the seventh biggest economy in the world, but they got the politics and the economics wrong. They've got a pretty good geography down there. So, you know, we're starting from a head start, but if you don't get it right, then you throw it all away.
And on the subject of South America, talking of old European cultures, the whole of the Americas is really controlled by two languages and a minority third, English and Spanish, and to a minor extent Portuguese. The impact of Brexit doesn't entirely put the three languages on the same side anymore. And Latin America has always had that problem, creating a unified continent in the same way that North America has achieved so incredibly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's more to do with geography and colonialism. Start with colonialism first. They went, you know, several countries went there and split it up. Most of them only were interested in getting inland to places that they could rob, then getting it back to the coast and sending it back to the old world.
Right.
And that's why to this day, their cities are not as well connected as they didn't bother to forge inland, create communities and link them to other communities, and it's held them back ever since. Secondly, the Spanish pretty much tried to continue with the feudal system and the great landowners. And the last bit being you've got the Andes, which, you know, separates one side of the continent from the other. They're trying to overcome that with modern technology, but they still have serious transport issues because of the Andes, which is the longest contiguous mountain range in the world. And of course, you have the Amazon, which also divides the continent. And you have parts of Argentina, which are desert, which are very hard to cross. So all that has held them back. In America, you have one relative monoculture, which once it gets across the Appalachian Mountains, it reaches the best farmland and best river system in the world. With this obviously, you know, there were Catholics, Protestants, Italians, Jews, you name it. But it was, compared to Latin America, it developed a monoculture. They then gave away the land that they'd stolen to ordinary people, which gave them a stake in making the country a success. And they also bought heavily into democracy. Unlike the Spanish colonies and then the independent countries. So all those things, as well as the amazing geography of the United States, partially explains the differentials in their purchasing power and technology and education levels to this day.
Tim, one of your exquisite talents is to distill to a very accessible, logical level, highly complicated geopolitical situations. Is there any conflict that you don't understand the logic behind, the ones perhaps which have too much religion or politics within them? Or can you actually logicize absolutely everything, whichever factor it might be?
I personally can't, because I don't know enough about certain conflicts. But I suspect you can do if you know enough about it. And there are some fundamentals, I think, you approach any dispute, any conflict with, and that is geography and and I'm saddens me to say this, but ethnicity. Mm-hmm. I think it goes very deep. I mean, look, this may be sort of COD psychology or some other science, but I do believe we are hardwired to be suspicious of the other. What we can do is overcome that hardwiring, but it takes a lot of work. But I start from the basis of geography, then you layer on history and politics. But when you see the geography, you think, right, this people in this particular argument come from there. Okay, there's a mountain there, there's some sea, farmland, whatever it is. These people down here have developed slightly differently because, you know, they're on the plain, and mountain people are often very different to lowland people. The peoples that used to herd their crops in certain areas, the crops were no longer there. They moved down to the sedentary peoples. And of course, then they're in competition. And if they can't agree how to share these limited resources out, they're going to clash. So, you know, I think you can reduce all these arguments down without misrepresenting them, and hopefully without, you know, making a cliche out of peoples. It's not an easy thing to do, but I think when you delve into whichever argument you're looking at, it comes down to the concept of the other, the history of how people developed, and the resources that they are hopefully cooperating over, but sometimes competing over.
Tim, you talk in the language of peace. You're a kind guy and a good mate in the business, and I thank you very, very much for your time today.
That's really very nice of you to say. I am, you know, well, I think most of us are. We most of us do want peace, but, you know, life gets very complicated. And I think sometimes a lot of people misunderstand other people for taking a side. Basically, we just really need to try as hard as we can to understand the other side and seek to make compromises. I'll leave you with that. I actually think compromise is a beautiful word.
If only John Lennon had called his record Compromise, you might have been more of a
compromise.
Fan.
Yes.
Yeah. It's easy if you try. Tim, again, thank you very much for a fantastic interview and quite certainly a world briefing.
Thank you, Johnny.
Cool, that was good. Oh, my goodness.
Well, yeah, I mean, but you because I
if you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or click on the PayPal icon on the donations page at jewishstate.co.uk, or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee at coffee.com/Johnny Gould. That's ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.